Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Opinions expressed on the First Coast Connect Week in Review are those of our panelists and do not reflect the views of WJCT News 89.9.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our First Coast Week in Review. Among our topics, a new leader for Duval County Schools, lingering concerns over the departure of yet another JEA chief, gay pride is displaced by state-mandated patriotism, a Black city council member calls a proposed hate crime bill insulting, and it's curtains for a beloved Five Points Theater after its new owners refuse to extend its lease. To talk about all that and more, I'm joined by Florida Times Union Metro columnist Nate Monroe. Good morning, Nate.
Good morning, Ann.
Tricia Booker, author, former reporter, and journalism professor at the University of North Florida. Hi, Tricia.
Hi, Ann.
Will Brown, race, poverty, and inequality reporter for Jacksonville Today. Hi, Will.
Good morning, Ann.
Good morning. And Lou Turner, a first-timer here today. Good morning, Jacksonville anchor and First Coast News anchor. Hi, Will. Lou. Hi, Lou.
Let me just go out on the record and say how disappointed I am that this is the first time.
Okay.
Let me just say it to your face.
Okay.
This is on record now.
All right.
This invite, I have been wanting to be on this show.
Lou?
Lou, it sounds like you've been saving this.
I have. I'm glad I saved it for radio.
And then she flubbed your name.
Isn't that something?
People should know that I've been asking Lou for months to come on, so
that
finally.
Is the joke. Yeah, and I apologize. Yeah.
Well, it's good to have you.
Well, I'm one of those TV. I'm too busy to get makeup done.
Yeah.
It's a problem.
All of the things that you have to do.
Right. Thank you, Ann. Good morning.
Good morning.
Sorry for derailing.
That's
you.
All right. No, it's a good morning and it's a good Friday. But I want to start with the news that we got yesterday about a unanimous school board vote for a Duval County superintendent. This is a seat that has been vacant for almost a year since Dr. Diana Green left. Will, remind us how we got to this point.
So Jeffrey Clayton got arrested on the campus of Douglas Anderson School of the Arts.
You're going right to the teacher.
Yes, starting there. Okay. In March of 2023, and the school board had big questions, and that led to former Superintendent Diana Green tendering her resignation. She made it effective May 2nd, 2023, in a mid-afternoon meeting when children were testing, and the school board then said, we're going to have this nationwide search. They only got 10 candidates in their first search in the fall, which was a third less than the number of candidates that Brevard County got last year and considerably less than most school districts in Florida received. So they suspended the search. Then they reopened the search at the start of this year, I think from March till April 15th. They had 21 applicants from 10 different states, 16 people with doctorates. They selected two semifinalists, Dr. Christopher Bernier and Dr. Smith from Virginia. And the school board unanimously selected Dr. Bernier, who was the former superintendent of schools in Lee County, otherwise most people in Florida know as Fort Myers. And he is not official because they have to do through the contract. He has to sign the contract. But if everything goes according to plan, he will be the guy and he will start on July 1st.
So he came here. It seemed like this was a long road, as you say, because it was nearly a year. There was an aborted search. They did it again. And yet there's something that almost feels a little bit hasty about this most recent approval process, because he was still sort of being vetted, at least journalistically, by the community. You know, some reports coming out about some controversies he left behind, including some reporting done by our colleague here at Jacksonville Today.
Yes. Our colleague Megan Malicote did some reporting about the timing of when Dr. Bernier resigned from Lee County. He submitted his application for the Duval County position on Lee County letterhead while still employed in Lee County. And then by the end of that week, he was out in Lee County. He resigned effective immediately when he led the board to believe, and the board accepted that he would step down in November of this year, because Lee County went from an appointed superintendent to an elected superintendent, and they're one of the largest districts in the state that has that will now have an elected superintendent. And Bernier has said publicly that is his position, that he would like to be an appointed superintendent instead of an elected superintendent.
As most probably would. We've got a call from John on the South Side. Good morning, John. Go ahead.
Well, good morning, Ann, and a good morning to your distinguished panel. And Lou, gosh, I remember just seeing you at a remote with Mike Prangley and Brooks Baptiste, and you got Katie, and can't wait to get you out on the kayak.
All right, John,
let's go.
John, I'm going to ask you just get to the question if you don't mind. Thank you.
Okay. Well, the question really is, I met at that meet and greet, at the stadium, and I also, had a chance to see Vicky Tavey, with the JEA, and the bottom line, really with this entire city, and bringing it together, it's going to be to unite, this whole entire, region in our waterway. And I really got the feeling. And also, too, I attended the River Accord yesterday. And let me just say, and you could probably announce this here, but I have a gut feeling that we're going to have the Lisa Reinemann River Accord Public Park on Pottsburg Creek. And it's going to be a real joint effort between the school board, JEA, and all the governmental agencies.
John, I'm going to put you on hold for a second. I want to kind of get back to the superintendent issue. So this was the first female superintendent in Duval County, Nate. That's not what we're going to get in this new superintendent. It is a, predominantly Black school district. How important is that for parents and teachers?
I mean, I can't speak for the Black community in terms of how important that is. I mean, I do think that Diana Greene's appointment... Excuse me, we were just joking about needing to clear our throat.
Right. So of course it happens a lot.
Yeah. I thought that her appointment years ago was viewed as meaningful. And her kind of ouster, her forced retirement from the district was controversial. And I do think, the Douglas Anderson issues certainly were some context happening around that time. But I mean, we never really got a clear explanation about why it is that she had to go in the first place. And so I do think that there are some kind of loose threads that have been hanging out around the school board and the superintendent search. And I do think that, some of the reaction about Diana Greene leaving came from Black parents and people concerned about why she was being ousted.
Yeah. There doesn't seem to be a particularly straight line from the problems at Douglas Anderson to Diana Greene. I never did see that. I mean, they didn't really.
But the board saw that.
Huh?
But the school board saw that.
Some did.
Not all, but just not disagree.
But they might have seen it, but they didn't draw it for us. I mean, it didn't seem like there was enough of an evaluation of how the school itself handled it. I don't know. It seemed to me to be a very kind of ambiguous connection between.
It is a very political environment. I mean, there was, I think, some sense that the state was narrowing its focus onto Diana Greene and her conduct and how things were being reported from the district. She had been the target of, a few letters from the Department of Education. So certainly there was some heat that was building on her. Mm. But Lou, the defining issue of this new superintendent is likely to be school closures. Mm. There are now 30 some schools that are on a draft, proposal to close. And that is going to be an incredibly incendiary issue for anybody. But this new superintendent's really going to start right into that.
Already has been, right? You've seen the Facebook groups that pop up already from out at the beaches, a couple of schools that had been purported to, maybe they're on the chopping block, maybe they're not. And it's all stuff that is draped in rumors. Are these particular elementary schools actually on any sort of block, or is it going to be consolidated? And now the focus is going to be, well, where are these school consolidations and closures going to happen? Will it happen to beach communities? Will it happen to more inner city, downtown Jacksonville schools? And whatever the optics are on that, it's going to play a big role in this superintendent's future. And going back several steps in superintendent's past, it seems like there just needs to be some length to one of these guys and gals. Somebody's got to stay. I mean, it seemed like Nicolae Vitti, if you remember going back, he was always bound. It always felt like to me he was bound and determined to get somewhere else. Dr. Diana Greene, actually, I felt like maybe she was for Jacksonville, but gone. I don't know. If you keep changing these people out every 2-3 years, how do you build trust in that position?
I want to take a call from Eugene. Go ahead, Eugene. You there, Eugene? We'll come back to you.
You know, but to Lou's point, I do wonder why the school board had a national search. What was the point of having a national search when each of the last four superintendents have had deep Florida ties? Mm-hmm. I mean, Bernier came from Lee County. Dr. Green came from Manatee County. Nikolai Vitti came up from Dade County. Ed Pratt Daniels was reared in this school district for 30-something years. Why have a national search when yesterday it was mentioned at the board meeting that Dr. Bernier's Florida ties was one of the reasons? Yeah. So what was the point of a national search when clearly recent precedent and their own preference was someone who's understanding the Florida community and the Florida environment?
They kind of said that getting up to speed on the world of Florida is significant, going to be something that Bernier brings to him. So we're going to go back to line two. We got Eugene from the north side. Let's try that again.
Hey, good morning, all. And I just want to make a comment on just two quick items, and you guys could comment I'll take your comments off the air. First of all, let's be honest, you guys are all intelligent, and we know Ms. Green or Dr. Green was terminated, but she left in a professional way. And two, this new superintendent is basically an extension of our establishment up in Tallahassee. So you could comment on that however you want to, but we're all intelligent. Let's be adults about this. Have a good day.
Thanks, Eugene. Tricia, you're in education. I mean, obviously there are increasing pressures from Tallahassee on every level of schools in Florida.
Yeah, and the optics aren't good. Like what Will was saying earlier on, he tendered his resignation, put his house up for sale, and basically, by all optics, looked like he knew he had the job before it was even coming up for a vote. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to me like there was the proper time for the community to get to know him or to figure out, have any kind of Q&A or figure out what his priorities are. Mm-hmm. And back to Lou's point about the school closures being one of the top issues that a superintendent's going to have to deal with, I read all of their answers to how they would handle this. I read a lot of jargon. What mm-hmm. I didn't read is a lot of people talking about the importance of really getting into the community. My teacher friends who work at inner city schools say they really believe that they are the ones who are going to get closed because they're not squeaky wheels. Yeah. I would highly doubt that Atlantic Beach Elementary is going to get closed. I mean, they have assembled this dynamic force of parents who are going to run the school themselves if they have to. But in the smaller, poorer communities, they don't have time for that.
It's a topic we're actually going to hit next week. We're going to have people from Atlantic Beach Elementary in that effort, but also the broader community. They're really trying to turn that into kind of an umbrella effort to serve all the schools that are on the chopping block and kind of defend community schools. But
just super quickly, like one thing that that Dr. Bernier is going to have to do is let the faculty and staff know some of these things, because I've spoken with faculty members and administrators at some of these schools that were on the chopping block or that their school might be consolidated, and they find out from media reports. Mm. They're not finding out from the district. So, you know, I spoke with one person earlier in April. She's been an educator in Duval County for 29 years, and she is the SAC chair at one school, and she's a teacher at another school, and both of those schools are on the projected close list, and she found out from media reports. Wow. And she's someone who is engaged in both of her the school her children attend and the school she teaches at, and she found out that way. So that's something that that Dr. Bernier is going to have to address, so that people aren't finding out the status of their job from
reporters
reading Jax Today.
Well, we're talking about the week's biggest headlines. You can join the conversation by calling 904-549-2937. You can also send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can actually watch our program live stream right now on Facebook and YouTube and see all these beautiful faces. But I want to move on now to the topic of JEA. It's an agency that doesn't need to manufacture drama, one that presumably and even desperately needs some leadership stability, Nate, and yet that's not what's happening.
It's not. The agency is still kind of mired in, I think, a sense of uncertainty because it most listeners of this program will know, I wouldn't say that Jay Stowe, the former CEO, was ousted, but was certainly he resigned from his position, I think, under pressure from the board. And the board did not really articulate any, it's a little bit like the Diana Greene situation. The board did not articulate any kind of clear, precise, serious reason that Jay needed to go. I mean, we were told, hey, you know, there's no scandal here. We just kind of have some philosophical differences. You know, maybe there's some O&M spending that's too high, maybe some capital stuff we have questions about, but, you know, it's fine. And so they bring in an interim CEO in Vicky Cavey, who's a long time, she had been retired, but she's kind of a long time presence at JEA. And, you know, here we are, we're more than a month out from all of that. We still have no kind of set timetable for when I'll use air quotes, permanent CEO is going to be selected. And we still don't really know why Jay Stowe was kind of forced out.
You say air quotes because you've noted that the idea of a permanent CEO at JEA, which has had, what, five, six leaders?
Yeah, in the last 6 years, five changeouts of CEO in the last 6 years.
And to be clear, Jay Stowe was handed kind of a flaming bag to handle, right? I mean, there was a indictment that had been issued. Now, you know, there's convicted former CEO fraud conspiracy for his actions at JEA. And the task that Jay Stowe was given was basically like provide some stability, stop this catastrophe, you know, get us back, right the ship. And he kind of did.
Yeah, I mean, I think that seems to be the consensus view. I do think that, you know, one of the big jobs I think he had was restoring trust among the workforce in the C-suite. And I think that there are five different employee unions that represent the unionized workforce at JEA. And I think that that's not a monolithic group, but I mean, I think broadly speaking that at that level of employment, there was a pretty broadly positive view of Jay Stowe. And so I think like he probably did that. And I do think there's a perception among a lot of employees that there was just this kind of weird board knife fighting going on. You know, the game's the High Lords play, right? And so, you know, here we are. The agency and the board, I think, are facing some suspicions about sunshine law issues, which kind of naturally arise anytime that board members kind of abruptly come to a consensus on something that is very complicated and should be contentious without any sort of debate, just kind of raises those issues. So, yeah, here we are. I mean, JEA is just cannot get out of its own way.
We actually have an email from Matthew on that. He says the JEA board is making questionable moves regarding leadership and the Office of Inspector General is investigating. He continues, the new leadership is actually old leadership of people that formerly retired. What is their end goal? Are they gearing up for another sale attempt? I mean, there's a lot of things to chew on there, but there is an Office of Inspector General investigation.
There is. To be clear, though, and actually to be fair to the board, I mean, my understanding of that is that somebody went to them and made a complaint, and so they are looking into the complaint. I don't want people to think that, like, this is an investigation that's, like, in a mature phase or something. I think this was just somebody lodged a complaint, and maybe that was based on stuff that's tangible that will lead to something or maybe not. I mean, again, the way it all went down kind of speaks to some sort of potential issue. You can just kind of look at the board meeting that day and wonder about sunshine law issues, and maybe that's what it was.
I think rightfully look at sunshine issues. I mean, when they voted on the contract, they voted to approve it with no discussion at all. My understanding is that she was hired shortly after, well, within a few months after the board had voted on certain criteria that were required for an executive, and then Vicky Cavey comes and they're like, well, she doesn't have it, but she's good. There were only four board members who voted on this contract for her that is a year contract with options to renew. That seems really unlikely that hadn't had prior discussion.
So I think it was after Zahn was ousted that the city council said that we want to make sure that the future executive has real experience, right? 5 years minimum, as you
yes,
say,
thank
Tricia.
You for correcting me.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a great point. It doesn't appear that she has any executive experience, Lou. She's been a director, but hasn't really had direct reports. At the same time, she is going to be collecting a $560,000 a year salary. That's $46,000 a month. I did the math, just was a little curious.
Nice. Well, plus $2,000 expense account, basically, and an $850 car allowance.
Yeah. I mean, like all of us.
So,
yeah.
Well, the exclamation points always go up when we're talking about big CEO money, right? And it's a different world than us journalists live in. You know what I mean? But in reality, that the CEO of such a major corporation, a major entity like Jay probably deserves to make. In fact, I mean, Jay was making more, you know, when he was, I mean, he was making more. So really her signing, I don't know if I'm in the defense or not, but I mean, she's going to be making what he was making when he first began, right? So the money is one thing, the allowances are another. It's more about it, that experience at the top level. Sure, she's been around a long time, but I mean, the hurdles, not only just getting public trust back, right, for JEA, but the hurdles they've got to face, talking about some new power plants, natural gas coming online. We've got, I mean, we're on the cusp, 5 days out from hurricane season. Right? Am I dates right? We're 6 days out from the beginning of a hurricane season, and one that's forecast, as I put my meteorological hat on, to be extraordinarily above average. So that's a hurdle, and that's going to be some big decisions are going to be made by somebody who's extraordinarily capable coming up here in the next few months and year.
And nobody has explained, like Nate was saying, why Jay Stowe wasn't that capable person. It sounds like he kind of was.
Right.
And I mean, it's not that there aren't valid criticisms that one could have of Jay. I think that there are, you know, clean energy advocates. I think the Sierra Club was, you know, has been attending board meetings for the last several years, asking for JEA to integrate more, you know, renewable energy into its future fuel mix. And you know, Jay, I think, was very much a kind of traditional public power CEO in the good sense. And, you know, maybe in, you know, again, some like clean energy folks would say in the bad sense that, you know, we're not going to be super creative in how we think about these things. But I don't think that's why the board got rid of him. You know, we just didn't hear a clear case for it. And this wishy-washy philosophical difference, it just doesn't really cut it, especially if you don't have a good succession plan in place. I mean, changing out CEOs is a big deal. You know, Wall Street, the credit rating agencies always pay attention to this. JEA's industry peers pay attention to this. Customers pay attention to it. The employees pay attention to it. You can't make a change of choice without having something clear in place after it.
So the question, we have an email also from Mark. He says, maybe the new CEO will stop the war on residential rooftop solar. That has been a big issue. Obviously, JEA, like every other power company, really hasn't been very progressive on incorporating rooftop solar. But I wonder, you know, big picture, what this says about JEA's vulnerability to a sale. So, you know, you still have a board that, you know, is trying to right the ship, restore trust in the community, be more accountable than the last board, pay more attention. But then, you know, you have questions about the process of this appointment. And I just wonder if there is a sense that JEA's sale future is truly kind of tabled for now, or if that's going to continue to be pressure that they're always facing.
I mean, I my own perception is that that's not any sort of imminent issue. I mean, the mayor is not going to support a sale. I don't think the board members in place there would support a sale, barring some very abrupt change in attitudes. I mean, I don't know that that's an imminent thing. But it's a big issue, and I'm sure at some point in the future it's going to come up again, because that's just kind of the life cycle of that idea.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there would be much interest in having that happen under a Democratic mayor, right? And that windfall align with her tenure. But further down the road?
Of course. I mean, it'll come up again for sure.
Okay. All right. Well, we're talking about the week's big headlines. If you want to weigh in, you can reach us on air at 904-549-2937. You can also email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. I want to talk about some pushback now to proposed anti-hate crime legislation. Jacksonville City Councilman Terrence Freeman slamming a proposed hate crime bill. He called it insulting and political pandering. Let's start, Will, with why do the bill's proponents say that this is needed?
It's to instill stiffer penalties for when people forget how to act. And that's just what I call incidents of racism. Because to me, even 8-9 months later, it is still extraordinarily hard to think about what happened in the Dollar General. And so that's what I call it, people forgetting how to act. And this legislation, from speaking with some of the people who have filed it, is to create stiffer penalties and to persuade people to remember how to act in public with people who are different from them. Councilmember Freeman has a different perspective on how to achieve that. And everyone's open to their own interpretation and opinion. But I can say with certainty, I remember seeing the pain on his face the day after the shooting at a vigil. And he stood right next to some other elected officials. So it is not that he doesn't believe that there shouldn't be penalties. He just believes differently from his peers on the council.
And we should be clear, for people who don't know, Terrence Freeman is a Black city council member. The person who proposed the bill, Jimmy Peluso, is not. This would increase fines and jail penalties. It would be tripled against anyone who was found to have expressed animosity, hostility, to any kind of range of protected people, including on a race base.
Yes.
But he said he was insulted by this, Will.
I read his statement. You know, it was one of those things that I was like, okay, that's your perspective. I didn't have public or private thoughts on it. I didn't fully understand why he was insulted. But it was one of those things that I just looked at and said, okay, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like, I have in my lived experience, in my professional experience, people have different ways for how they can, for lack of a better way of saying it, eradicate racism. And Freeman's is clearly different from his peers like Rockman Johnson and Tyrone Clarke Murray and Jacoby Pittman, all of whom co-introduced this bill alongside Jimmy Peluso.
Nate.
Yeah, I was just going to make that point that Jimmy Peluso is white, but the bill has four Black co-sponsors on the city council, and they're the four other Black members of the city council other than Terrence Freeman. So,
and tell us a little bit about the dynamic that Terrence was elected with, Nate, because that was unusual, the way that he won his district in terms of the breakdown of the support that he had.
So Terrence Freeman is a Republican. He's a Black Republican, and we have, you know, a Black Republican sheriff. We, in the last iteration of the council, Terrence Freeman and Sam Newby were both Black Republicans. So this was sort of quietly like the most bizarre result, from the elections last year. This got, I think, a little bit overlooked, understandably, because of the result of the mayor's race. But, Terrence Freeman's opponent when Terrence was running for reelection was a white libertarian. And, Terrence Freeman actually got less of the Black vote in Jacksonville than this white libertarian opponent did. Which is crazy. That's never going to happen again. Like, a libertarian is never going to win various Black precincts. And you can kind of look at the precinct map, and it's like exactly like it looks like the kind of racial breakdown of the city. And so I think one thing here is I think it is fair to question. When Terrence Freeman says, as a Black man, I am insulted by this legislation, does Terrence Freeman's views meaningfully reflect broader public attitude about Black voters and Black residents in the city?
I don't know, but I would say that the libertarian he competed against, Eric Parker, was at so many community events. You would see Eric Parker everywhere, and he was saying, I'm running for city council. He'd give out his card, he'd give out his contact information, and he had so many touch points with so many different people from across the city, which might explain why he overperformed as a libertarian candidate, because we haven't had a libertarian on the council as a libertarian party member since I've been here in Jacksonville. So that might explain some of it. But to your point about do his views reflect all Black voters? The thing I've realized in my lived experience is sometimes folks might say things in public and they might say things at the cookout that are quite different. And so Terrence Freeman's views are reflective of more African Americans than folks realize, because that is what folks tell me when it's like, I'm not being a reporter, I'm just being Will Brown. So it doesn't surprise me to answer your question.
I want to take a call from Wells on the South Side. Good morning, Wells. Go ahead.
Good morning to your guests. I briefly spoke at the meeting they had this week on this hate crime legislation or proposal. I still don't understand what Mr. Friedman is saying. As a matter of fact, I heard him speak at a meeting this past week. And I think he's kind of beating around the bush. That's the way I look at it. The issue here is that this is a piece of paper. What really needs to be done is we need to have the hard discussion in this city like they've had in other cities, and like they had Truth and Reconciliation in South Africa, which I visited last year. We have to get to the root cause of race and racism in this country, which could have been dealt with during Reconstruction had it not been overthrown by white supremacists. So I think that one of the things that I said was that there's supposed to be a crime unit here in Jacksonville, or a gang unit. I asked whether or not T.K. Waters has a unit that's ferreting out white supremacist organizations in Jacksonville. Thank you.
Thanks, Wells. Appreciate it. We've got a call also from Charles on the West Side. Go ahead, Charles.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Hi, Wells. I'm just wondering where, you know, we have all these black MAGA, well, not all these, but we have a few black MAGA Republicans here in Florida, like Terrence and the other guy, Donald, over there in the West, Panhandle, I think. Geez, where is this right-wingish stuff coming from by some members of the black community?
Charles, thanks. Want to answer that, Will?
I think Congressman Donald, is down in Southeast Florida, if I recall properly. I can't remember every single member of the Florida delegation that's not here in Northeast Florida. But to that point, you know, there are people who believe, hey, the government doesn't need to be all of my business. And that is how and why some become small government, protect the family type of politics. And right now, the party that reflects small government and protect the family are Republicans. So it's not completely far-fetched. Though I have to say something about what Wells Todd said about Reconstruction, because it's something that always comes to my mind. He talked about Reconstruction. In 1876, Florida was one of three states whose votes had to be counted and recounted, and that is how Rutherford B. Hayes became the president, and that is how Reconstruction happened. So if people didn't show up to the polls in 1876 and in Florida, and guess what? Rutherford Hayes became the president and ended, and that is how Reconstruction ended. Listen to that history lesson and apply yourself. Govern yourselves accordingly, as some folks say at church.
Wells was also talking about the importance of fighting white supremacy and that sort of thing. And I think that's probably one of the things that the criticisms of this bill is, how is it actually going to be manifested into the community? I mean, if you look at it, comparing it, kind of foisting it upon the Dollar General mass shooting, they to me seem like apples and oranges. I mean, how are you going to triple the penalty on the perpetrator of the Dollar General shooting? It's just, I don't know. It doesn't seem relevant. I mean, this bill would not have prevented something like that.
Yeah, I think they're aiming a little smaller, but you know, just in terms of like more misdemeanor type offenses, Lou. But I think chewing away at, you know, the structural part of acceptable racism in Jacksonville is something people on all sides, all both parties, have an interest in.
I think didn't Freeman say it was political pandering, something like this, and that there's already things in place at the state level, you know, at the federal level as well. And maybe his point, I'm not gonna put words in his mouth, but I'm just wondering, okay, so we're tripling now. And a Democrat or whoever's sponsoring this can put their flag on the mountain and say, hey, I fought this. And then the next council comes around and says, but I quadrupled it, and I'm going to quintuple it. I'm going to 10 times these penalties. Right. And you're right. I mean, so I can see, because he sponsored local hate legislation right after Dollar General.
It was when someone
put up some
hateful displays on the CSX building.
Correct. Okay. That's so, and we're talking about this when you say the misdemeanors and things like that. I can't get in the mind of a mass shooter, but maybe these things manifest themselves at the small level. We're getting hate. You find pamphlets filled with hate in people's mailboxes, anti-Semitic messages painted up on public buildings. And, you take that from whatever the penalty was and you triple it. Maybe it discourages it, but it's about catching the people as well.
Sure. There's the question of normalizing.
To be fair to Lou's point, since that legislation that Freeman introduced last year, there were no incidents of people flashing symbols on public property, as was the case in 2022 and early 2023. I also remember a politician, I can't remember which side of the aisle, said it. You can't legislate. You can't tell people how to feel through legislation.
Yeah. Well, I want to move on to a different.
The city council does that quite often. I do find the complaints about political pandering sort of mind blowing. That's who is not guilty of that among the 19 council members? Like, give me a break.
Fair. I want to talk about an issue that emerged this last week. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is calling this Freedom Summer. His edict requires that state bridges shine red, white, and blue lights, those that have lights this summer. Tricia, that essentially prevents cities from using other lighting, including rainbow lights for Pride Month. That's been an issue in Jacksonville over a couple of times.
Yeah, it's not a good look. It's getting us more national attention. Florida continues to look like the state that hates diversity. To me, it also, because I don't think people really distinguish between what's happening on the state level and on the local level. It's kind of do as I say, not as I do, because here you have the city council trying to prevent hate crimes, but at the same time, we are being prevented from expressing, the city is being prevented from expressing support for LGBTQ community in the Juneteenth holiday. I think that we will continue to be kind of a source of ridicule, perhaps, because of that.
Florida? I'm just kidding. So, Lou, this is not the first time the state has attempted to block rainbow lights on the Acosta Bridge. It happened back in 2021. There was sort of a huge dust up about it. And then the state said no. And they backed off. They said they'd gotten complaints. Mm-hmm. It turned out that maybe there had not been much record of complaints.
Were the complaints real?
Right.
Right. And there would be a paper trail, wouldn't it? I mean, and there's plenty of people who would be asking, well, where'd the complaints come from? And maybe, you make that complaint. You don't want your name associated with a complaint.
Yeah. Well, I think we do know that maybe the complaint came from one person in the governor's mansion.
Okay.
Maybe. Right. I mean, I wrote about this back then, and the governor's office got furious because the idea was, why is the governor doing this? Why is he shutting down these lights? And the criticism then was, why would the governor care about Jacksonville's lights? That's stupid to draw this connection. And a few years later, like, here we are, Freedom Summer, whatever.
To that point about the Freedom Summer, I just have to say this. This is not the first time that Governor DeSantis has co-opted language that has been previously used by civil rights organizations to suit his political purposes. I mean, the whole etymology of the word woke was for black folks to stay safe in the South in the 30s and 40s because folks might come up and grab and lynch you. And so it has been co-opted into something that suits his political purposes and the purposes of others. And Freedom Summer, I'm sorry, but Freedom Summer is 1964. It is not anything that is happening in the state of Florida in 2024 regarding lights on any bridge.
It is the civil rights movement summer of that effort to...
Yes, which... St. Augustine is celebrating the 60th anniversary of its Freedom Summer activities next month. That is Freedom Summer, not this.
It also kind of commits the sin that it's claiming it's rectifying, because it has this very didactic, here is how you are to celebrate being an American and like summer. Like it's just this kind of ridiculous thing. It's claiming it's going to stop people from virtue signaling by itself, virtue signaling something. It's just ridiculous.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the head of the DOT who said that he was going to be putting these red, white, and blue lights, this order out, he thanked the governor and said, Florida continues to be the freest state in the nation.
I mean, it makes his job easier, right? FDOT guy. Listen, I don't have to get all the colors. I don't have to go get a bunch of different LED lights and put them up there. I'm just red, white, and blue. Job's done. Summer.
Is he just saying that because the state budget hasn't been signed yet?
Maybe that's what
it is. Very difficult to think of it as Freedom Summer when you have a population of LGBTQ people who are literally afraid to go to the pride parades. They are increasing security at the Pride parades because of all of the threats that they're getting. So how can it be Freedom Summer where you're not free to express who you are, and cities are not free to express support for different ideologies and groups? It doesn't make sense.
We should say we've learned from a JTA source that this cancels about 36 scheduled light events. It's not just Pride. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Juneteenth, but there's usually 10 to 12 a month. There's 20 in September alone. And so there really is going to be a number of organizations whose representation is going to be diminished. I want to move on just briefly because we've only got a few minutes left, but Sunray Cinema this week learned that it is not going to have its lease renewed. The building has been sold. This is an iconic facility. It means a lot to a lot of people in Five Points, Lou. I know that there's a lot of discussion at the community level about this.
Yeah. The first ever talkie in Jacksonville was shown at theaters there. Maybe not when Sunray, right, at the time, because that's been around since 2011, but at least that historical. So I bounce a question back to everybody if I can. What's the first talkie you ever saw? Just a movie with sound? Anything that you can remember?
I mean,
do you know the first movie?
Might have been King Kong.
Where it was? No? Yeah. Mine was Ghostbusters 2, 1989.
Two?
I was one when the first one came out, I was old enough to get to the sequel. Anybody remember their talkies?
I can't remember the first movie I saw.
Do you remember the last talkie you saw? I mean, you know, people aren't really going out anymore, and it's a bummer. It's a beautiful building. Like I said, it's been around since 2011. You've got this company out of Atlanta coming and buying up these historical spaces and rejuvenating them, whatever that's meant. I know there were rumors that they were going to that have been debunked. They were going to bulldoze it and turn it into parking, you know, there.
Or even a golf facility. But Nate, what is the consensus? I mean, this is just going to happen. There's nothing the community can do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I guess this is a business cycle. This is the day and age in which we live. You know, landlords can do what they want with properties, and Sunray was a tenant. You know, people don't always realize that some of these cool local businesses do not own their buildings, and so, you know, this can happen in waves, and we've seen a number of really well-liked establishments go away.
Tom on Facebook says, I will never set foot in whatever business takes the place of Sunray Cinema. Sunray Cinema is an iconic part of the Five Points community. It is a loss.
Yeah, for sure. The building itself has historic protection, right? So
some local protection.
Local protection.
The exterior, yeah.
Yeah. But Sunray was kind of an anchor for a really cool part of Jacksonville that has just a very different vibe. And so I think the hope is that these new folks are going to come in and do something that's going to help preserve that.
Well, we'll be watching it. Will Brown, Lou Turner, Tricia Booker, and Nate Monroe, thank you all so much for being here today. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Up next, we talk with Grammy-winning R&B artist Jameson Ross about returning home to play the Jazz Fest.
Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Serious injury cases are complex, and civil trial attorneys present the evidence juries need to see and hear. More at waynehogan.law.
Medical experts discuss this month's healthcare headlines. I'm Dr. Joe Servin. Join me tomorrow at 4 for What's Health Got to Do with It? Only in WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville.
On the next Florida Roundup, leadership, free expression, and civility. We speak with three authors, historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, novelist Lauren Groff, and former Florida lawmaker Dick Batchelor, about those issues and more. Think of it as a summer reading list as the 2024 political season heats up. This is Tom Hudson. Join us Friday at noon.
Join us for the 35th anniversary of the National Memorial Day Concert, a night to honor our troops, our veterans, and our military families.
Join me, Joe Mantegna.
And me, Gary Sinise.
With Bryan Cranston, B.D. Wong, Jenna Malone, Mary McCormick, Gary Lovox, Ruthie Ann Miles, Jamie Johnson, Bettina Miller, and Cynthia Erivo.
The National Memorial Day Concert.
Live, Sunday night at 8 on Jax PBS. Watch on demand by downloading the PBS app.
The doors are staying open at Graceland for now, but is one about to shut on the former president in Manhattan? Also,
Biden has been a catastrophe, so I will be voting for Trump.
Nikki Haley, who told us that Trump is a disaster and unhinged, will vote for him. And OpenAI finds itself in a very public fight with one of Hollywood's biggest stars. It's all on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Deep down in Florida, where the sun shines every day.
And we're back. The Jazz Fest is literally at our doorstep here at WJCT. The Metro Park stage is all ready to go, and one of its featured artists is actually here with me in studio. Jameson Ross is a Grammy-winning R&B and soul artist, and he's actually hails from Jacksonville originally. Welcome back, Jameson.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
Is it nice to be home?
I'm glad to be home, you know, really happy to be here.
So you live in New Orleans now, but you were once a DA kid. You went to Douglas Anderson School of the Arts.
Yes, I walk all of these streets in Jacksonville, Florida, from the west side of town, went to La Villa Middle School of the Arts, and then of the DA. And to be honest with you, I feel like I developed my love for music here in Jacksonville. So I'm smiling right now because this place has a lot of memories for me.
So what does it mean to you to come back here and play Jazz Fest? You've done it before.
You know, when I first got the call that they wanted me to come play, it was, to me, it was a good sign that the year was going to be great. That's just how I put Jacksonville in such a special place in my heart, because my entire family is from here. My grandfather was a pastor. My dad was a minister of music, played the piano, and had a community choir in town. So I have so many memories of music, family, fun, and development in this city. And so to come back and to show my city what I've been doing and how I've developed as an artist, you know, it makes my chest stick out and my cheeks get stuck, you know.
Yeah. So. Were you able to attend the Jazz Festival when you lived here? Did you go growing up at all?
So I played once or twice with Douglas Anderson, the big band, with the direction of Ace Martin. So I had a few memories there. University of North Florida, they had a jazz festival as well that I played. But for the most part, I don't remember really like participating in the jazz festival, like going to see the music, or remember it being like it is now. It has changed drastically.
Yeah. And so you are a drummer and a singer, and that's an incredibly complex marriage of disciplines. Some people straight up can't do it. So how did you begin to do those two things simultaneously?
You know, it was a natural evolution. Me drumming and singing was something that naturally kind of happened. My talents, I always grew up singing with my grandfather, singing with my dad and mom. And I went to school for a jazz drum set, to study jazz drum set at Florida State University, and then continued to get my master's at University of North Florida. But me singing was something that was a natural gift that was just given to me. And so as I developed as an artist and got creative, started being around people, friends, like John Batiste, friends like Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, I saw their creativity, and it inspired me to actually like use everything that I felt like God had given me, you know, all of my abilities. And so where I'm at now, singing and playing the drums, is what I call a beautiful relationship of God's improvisation, melody, rhythm with the drums and voice.
Is it difficult, though, to focus and to not kind of lose your rhythm when you're singing and you're playing a different, and you play really complicated drums?
Yes, it is difficult. To be honest with you, sometimes I'm out of breath. Sometimes I can't breathe. Sometimes I'm sweating profusely. But to be honest with you, I've learned over the past 10 years of me developing in this artistry that, you know, it's also on a string. My voice and my rhythmic approach is on a string. So it moves together. I don't really look at it as an independent, you know, independence exercise. It's really about unity, about the relationship together. Mm. And so for me, that's how I approach my singing and playing the drums as well.
So you got your first Grammy nomination in 2015. It was right after you graduated and got your advanced degree, right?
Yes. I graduated in 2012 or 2013, and I put my first album out called Jameson on Concord Records, and I got a Grammy nomination for Best Jazz Vocal Album. Changed my life. Changed my life completely.
It must have been an incredibly heady experience.
Yeah, except hearing no. Hearing no at the Grammys was tough. You know, it was a weird feeling, but to be honest, looking back on it, it was the thing that affirmed my artistry. To get a Grammy nomination that young in my career for what my ideas were musically, it really changed my life.
Then you got another one in 2019, and last year you won your first Grammy.
So I did.
Congratulations.
Oh, man, that one was special, too, you know, winning with Snarky Puppy, because I am a member of Snarky Puppy.
And for people who don't know Snarky Puppy, it's kind of a massive band, right?
Massive, what I call world music collective, a culture vulture collective of geniuses that play music together. And I've been a part of them for about 8 years. And so they are a special group of artists that I love to play with. And we won a Grammy for Empire Central last year.
Well, congratulations. So your new single, Say You Love Me, is in the Billboard Top 20 now.
Come on. Say You Love Me. Yeah, it is.
And it is the Say You Love Me tour that's kicking off. You're going to be starting it tonight at 5:30 on the Daily's Place stage. It's so nice to meet you, and we're really looking forward to seeing you out there.
Thank you so much for having me. Say You Love Me tour coming to a city near you.
All right. And that's our program. We encourage your feedback and suggestions. You can send either to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We're taking a break Monday in observance of Memorial Day, but join us again Tuesday when we discuss the latest court battle over Jacksonville's panhandling ban. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Say. Say I'm the one your eyes can see. Tell me you need me. Need me. Deep down inside, like I need you. I need you to see me through. I wanna hear you say. Baby, 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 I love you. Through the rain and through the cold.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.